Also, yes.
Alright, this is Pure Decking, show number 349 for Thursday. I don't actually care what day it is. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like information security, rigging the game, and leaving cardboard stand-ups of Batman. I did that joke last week. Okay.
See the dangers of writing intros? That's
yeah.
Why I fucking freeball them, dude.
Yeah.
Fuck them up. God, I love your new soundboard edition of the sneeze. That's fantastic.
The Morbs, do you want to play Batman?
No. No. You should play Batman, Madman. Your parents are already dead.
Well, I wish I would have known this before my last trip home.
Oh, fuck. And 3, 2, 1, darkness.
I'm not even kidding. That's the bad part. Fuck. We're getting old. I'm Morbs. I'm feeling old, and tonight we have Madman, who's probably still sore at me for making a parents joke.
Oh, no, I was setting up for a parents joke. It's all good.
Oh, I'm finishing off my Knob Creek single barrel. What do you got tonight, Madman?
I have a Sam Adams Summer Ale. Kind of citrusy.
And, go ahead.
It's not quite a summer shandy, but I can taste one from there.
Interesting. And a rare edition, we have BSV.
Hello. I'll try to avoid the sneezing powder.
You're going to have to try really hard. We've been leaving it in strategic locations throughout your home.
Next to Batman cutouts.
Was just developing allergies.
That's all right. Next week, it's going to be those plastic hands that you're supposed to use to like slam in car doors and trunks to scare people. You're just going to, open up the medicine cabinet, and it's just going to be full of those instead of, the normal stuff you expect to have in a medicine cabinet. I can't think of any examples of what's actually supposed to be in most people's medicine cabinets.
Don't look in the medicine cabinet. I need to clean that out first. There may be non-plastic.
The thing is, the Xanax I get, the toothpaste I get, why the Zima? That I'm confused on why the Zima is in there.
To wash down the Xanax. How else are you going to drink a Zima without a bottle of Xanax?
Oh, and RU is also here.
Yeah, I'm regretting not shaving this morning. I was growing, I'm trying to grow a bit of, I grow a facial hair like I'm a bear. Just because I'm walking in the morning, trying to keep my face warm in the winter. It's got to that point where it's itchy.
Mm.
I just got to get rid of it. I feel like a fucking hairy caterpillar is crawling all over my face. Fucking terrible.
Give it another week, dude. You'll be fine.
Yeah, no, I don't want to give it another week. I'm fucking sitting here and fucking clawing like I'm a meth head, dude. Fucking sores all over my face. Dude, you do meth? No, I'm trying to grow a beard.
It's like, yeah, that goes away in a week.
Yeah. No, it's at that point where I'm like, fuck it, get it off.
You know what's weird, though, is when you wear a beard for a few months or longer, and then when you shave it off, you have that same weird feeling. Now there's nothing on your face.
Oh, yeah, dude, I've gone the full Viking before, the whole, let it grow out for years at a time, and then go on the clean shave one day, and holy fuck, my face is missing.
Yeah.
What happened? It was the slightest little breeze, and you're feeling chilly.
Yeah. So, anyways, it's like, you try to make it look nice, so it's, you trim it, and then you fuck it up, and you're like, I guess I just might as well shave it off so I don't look like an asshole.
I'm the fool, you either go hobo or you go home, you know what I mean? There's none of this, I trim my beard because I'm a beard conservative, and I use beard oil and shit like that.
Oh, no, I'm not going that far. I'm just, I work in an office and don't want to get fired, so... It's like, you know, if they think you're a hobo just sleeping in there, they might get upset.
Shit, man, if you can slap a dress on and call yourself a woman, you can grow a beard that's fucking rough and not get fired.
If they start complaining, Mups, just say you've been working really late shifts and haven't been able to go home.
That's, you know, BSV, there are times when the truth is funny and times when it just hurts. And the fact that I was, you know, decided to work from home today and just wrapped up about an hour ago. Yeah. It's like, you know, you realize you're still sending emails at 8 o'clock, and it's just like, fuck.
Stop ruining my jokes with your reality.
My reality is your joke, BSV.
Yeah, about the nature of reality right now. This is why we have alcohol. Anyways.
According to a survey, America is fourth behind, I think it's Canada, in drinking per capita.
Oh, sure. We have plenty of teetotalers and Mormons and shit like that. But yeah,
Britain has the highest. Australia comes second. Always runner-up.
Well, you guys need to try harder and get past Britain so you can get that big foam finger, you know, number one.
Nah, man, fuck it. I'd drink if I was British as well. I'm only descended from British. That's why I half drink.
So, anyways, let's get into the stories here. So, first one we have is actually from the Register, and this is kind of the lead. This is a Google took an interesting reaction to the latest Intel, predictive or speculative execution vulnerability, which Intel is now starting to call, what are they calling it, microarchitecture vulnerabilities or something like that. Anyways, the most common fix for this is to just turn hyper-threading off. And with this last one, Intel was saying that really won't help you that much. But I guess to explain it a little bit, they found yet another speculative execution bug that leaks data in Intel processors, and apparently it's been there for a while. And if you're not aware of what this is, Intel processors, when they get an instruction from whatever you're running, program, operating system, whatever, a lot of times they have a table of like, okay, normally after this command, it's going to be one of these 6 or 10 or 15 commands. So it'll go run all those too. So it's got the response ready for you before you even throw it the next instruction. This makes the machine appear much faster. And this is also how parts of hyperthreading work, is that it's like, okay, I know that the command I'm running on this virtual core, you know, the next 5 commands are probably likely to be in this instruction, you know, this group of instructions, you know, however many it actually is. I'm horribly butchering the explanation of this, so don't get too bent out of shape if I get it. You know, the broad strokes should be roughly right. And so hyperthreading then goes, okay, and so on the other virtual core on this physical core, it says, okay, the instruction I'm running over here has this other collection of commands that are likely to be next, and as long as they don't cross or interfere with each other, it can run them both at the same time because it's actually physically separate parts of the circuitry. So that's what that is. That's where this comes from. It's not the only thing it's used from, but that's like the biggest part, if I remember this right. And so this is, you know, you keep seeing these bugs come up and people getting upset because when they fix them, it hurts performance of the chips. Like they were saying in worst case scenario, it's like 30% performance drop in these chips when they fix it. Well, what's happening is these predictive instructions to be fast aren't doing things like, say, respecting memory map or memory access restrictions. So you end up with code with instructions able to access memory in parts of the chip that they really shouldn't be. And so they're manipulating this microcode in the chip to talk to areas of memory that they're not supposed to be able to talk to. When you're talking about your laptop, your desktop, game console, whatever, not that big of a deal because it's all still your data mostly. I mean, yeah, you can have, if you've got malware or something in there, it could potentially be getting at things it shouldn't. You could have programs potentially screwing with things they shouldn't, causing the computer to crash or be unstable, things like that. Where this is really an issue is data centers, especially cloud data centers like your AWS's, your Azure's, your Google Cloud, where suddenly you've got, you know, lots of different people living on one system, and they're able to, you know, run whatever code they upload because that's the service, right? You're providing virtual machines on your hardware for other people to use. And now they could potentially use this speculative execution bug to grab instructions from other people's processes running on the same servers. And given the way some of these cloud guys bounce your virtual machines around their hosts, you could be collecting data from all over the map. So they need to fix these things pretty quickly. Slight problem, 30% performance drop. And again, on your desktop or on a laptop, I mean, it's obnoxious, especially if you're, you know, running a little bit older gear and you're still trying to keep up on modern games, or if you're doing high-end workstation-style stuff, rendering high-end CAD, video editing, or if you're just one of these enthusiast guys who, you know, you get your rocks off by maintaining that rock-solid, you know, frames per second, and, you know, having two more frames per second than the next guy in the group, you know, just makes you the most badass guy. And now you're all taking a frames hit because of this bug fix, right? Again, it's obnoxious, but it's not really that devastating to an individual machine. But again, with data centers where they're selling that capacity and they take a 30% hit, they have to go buy servers to cover that 30% hit because it's across everything that's using these Intel chips.
So the fix, is it a software fix or are they doing a BIOS update so that the chip works differently?
It's both. There are operating system fixes that try to implement controls for these problems in software. That's not as fast as the BIOS fix where they actually go update the microcode that's running on the processor. The problem that you run into there is that you have to get the BIOS updates out and deployed. So it's still downtime to get these nodes all updated, and you still have to go bounce every box to get the BIOS updated. And you're still looking at a performance hit because they're now making these instruction sets respect the memory boundaries. You know, like ring one can't hit ring zero memory and shit like that, right? So because they're doing that, that means that they're adding complexity to this microcode, which slows it down because now it's having to watch for things that it's not watched for before. And arguably, it should have been doing always from the beginning. But, I mean, you know, you think about it. If you have a data center that's suddenly 30% slower, they have to go buy servers to cover that gap. That's a real cost.
Not only that, but they also purchased an item that's not performing as advertised. I wonder if they can hit the manufacturer for that.
Potentially.
Because, like, if I buy, I don't know, a 30 gigahertz chip, I'm not sure what's actually fast anymore. I don't care. Mine works. And I'm only getting 20. That's not what I paid for. That's not what I'm specking my system out for.
So speed hasn't been, you know, like you know, raw clock speed hasn't really been the big thing for a while. You know, your average laptop is clocking in usually around 2. If you've got the $100 Walmart special, it's probably more like 1.5. But you know, they're bouncing in around 2-ish, 2.5. You know, your nicer machines, you're getting up into the 3.5 gigahertz range. Your high-end enthusiasts are usually rocking 4. Where it gets interesting is the number of cores in these machines now. That's how they've been getting more performance out of them. With that and just making the chips more efficient. You know, you take an 8th gen, you know, Core i5 and put it against a 2nd gen Core i7, that i5 is probably going to win. Because it's just more efficient and the instruction set is cleaner. So, but, you know, of course, you're also looking at several generations of improvement there, but that's not the point. Right. Anyways, so like, you can get on, you know, I've got some machines I've put together just on eBay, old data center stuff, where I've got, you know, 8-core Xeons. sitting in the closet right now. I don't run the box that often because it's loud as balls. But when I'm doing something, I need the kind of horsepower. Yeah, I can kick that thing on and go through a workload at it. You know, I got 2 8-core Xeons sitting in that machine. So I've, you know, got a 16-core, you know, 3 gigahertz Xeon R710. They're older Xeons, and again, you get the same thing with the generations being faster. But you know, I mean, you can get on eBay and get this stuff pretty cheap. You can actually get old server gear and get a lot of horsepower for a couple $100s. Really, there. You know, you do occasionally see the write up where somebody said, "Hey, here's a cheap way to build a gaming rig. You know, go on eBay and buy an old micro server, you know, with these Xeon chips in it, hack it into a case, and you know, duct tape a graphics card into it, and hey, you've got a gaming machine. You can't update it and hope to God that it never breaks because there's no warranty, no support, no, you know, nothing officially is ever going to support this Franken build. But you know, you spent $300 and you've got a respectable gaming rig." So, if you're doing home lab stuff or just, you know, things that aren't, you know, you're not running it outside of the realm of being a server, which is what most of this gear is geared towards. You know, it's fine. But anyway, so back to this article here from the Register. Chrome OS is axing hyper-threading over the data leak flaws. So I was talking earlier about just turning hyper-threading off, and I think it was NetBSD just did that anyways because of all the Intel bugs that they were finding last year. So now Chrome OS is doing it. They're just saying, yep, nope, too many security bugs, turning hyper-threading off. Love it. In conjunction with Intel's coordinated disclosure today about a family of security vulnerabilities discovered in millions of its processors, Google has turned hyper-threading in Chrome OS, or turned off hyper-threading in Chrome OS to fully protect its users. Meanwhile, Apple, Microsoft, IBM's Red Hat, Cubes OS, and Zen advise customers they might want to do that too. You know, hyper-threading is a fairly big deal, especially in server workloads. That's a pretty drastic step, performance-wise. So the family flaws are dubbed microarchitecture data sampling, and Chipzilla's official advisory is they've got a link, along with the necessary microcode updates to mitigate the data leaking vulnerabilities and a list of affected products. Installing these fixes and disabling Intel's hyper-threading feature is a sure way to kill off the bugs. There may be a performance hit as a result. Then they go on to explain, you know, some of the things. And, you know, Google said disabling hyper-threading by default in Chrome OS 74, citing security concerns, and noting that Chrome OS 75 will have additional mitigations. The decision to disable or enable hyperthreading is a security versus performance trade-off, said the web giant's people in a vulnerability notice. With hyperthreading disabled, Intel CPUs may experience reduced performance, which varies depending on workload. But with hyperthreading enabled, users could execute code, such as by visiting a website or running an Android app, that exploits MDS to read sensitive memory contents. Google has further details. Yeah, so they've got a link to Google's announcement. OpenBSD has already done this as well. So, okay, it was OpenBSD, not NetBSD. Good to know, because I couldn't remember. But, yeah, he's just, you know, they're just flat out saying, turn it off. You don't need it. Let's see. Apple released Mojave 10.14.5 to address MDS attacks via JavaScript and Safari, but says comprehensive fix requires turning off hyper-threading, and they're not doing it by default because of the performance hit. Microsoft said to be fully protected, customers may need to disable hyper-threading. Windows has released operating system updates to mitigate the design flaw in conjunction with microcode updates. Yeah, so everybody else is saying they should probably do it. Google's just doing it by default in Chrome OS. So
do you think this is going to give AMD any type of advantage if they go into the server market?
So AMD had a share of some of these bugs too. And that's not terribly surprising given how often AMD and Intel trade technology, because they got to keep their chips compatible with each other, and they have these patent agreements that, you know, they could both go nuclear with patents and then prevent the other from making chips, basically. So they've got licensed technology from each other. Intel licensed the 64-bit instruction set from AMD because they got theirs out first. And that's like the easy one to point at. But of course, AMD's licensed several instruction sets from Intel as well. So I don't think they're going to be the same vulnerabilities, and they haven't found nearly as many in the AMD chips. And the Zen architecture that AMD is pushing is a newer build, and it's got a lot of their own stuff in it. So I think, yeah, Rats, you should read up on the patent deals between Intel and AMD. It's pretty crazy. And, you know, IBM's got a share of them in there too. And you actually see something similar between Qualcomm, Intel, and Apple with regards to radio modem technology. So it's interesting. It's a whole bunch of handshake agreements, and like VIA, if you remember them, they actually bought out Cyrix, because back in the early days, Cyrix, if anybody even knows who the hell I'm talking about when I'm talking about Cyrix processors, they were still competitive in the 486 and Pentium 1 days. A lot of people think they went out of business because Quake didn't run very well on their processors. You know, Quake 1, the original one.
That would kill you in the market, man. Well, that's... Like, how many copies did Quake sell?
How many pirated
copies of Quake were there?
So that's why a lot of people think it killed it, because apparently Quake ran like ass on their chips, because the way they had done some of their instruction sets that Quake used just weren't up to snuff, or weren't even there. But back in the early days, the 286, 386 days, actually, it might even be earlier than that, Cyrix had some of their engineers basically completely reverse engineer an x86 chip. So they actually had a processor, an x86 compatible processor that was completely unencumbered by intellectual property. And so when they started to go under, there was all kinds of bidding on them, because they had this design that was not encumbered by Intel or AMD intellectual property. So, yeah.
Nice. Whoever buys it can go mad on the other.
Well, that's what
still put out a chip.
Well, that's VIA bought them, and that's where the. You see a lot of these embedded systems running via chips and thin clients and shit like that. I forget what happened to VIA. Are they still around?
I have no idea, man. I haven't looked at hardware for years.
I mean, because they were a weird one. VIA chip.
They've probably changed names a few times now.
VIA Technologies. Looks like they still exist.
Awards in 2019. They may have won something too.
Yeah, I mean they've still been they're still doing stuff, but they don't show up that often, because they're often, you know, they're making, you know, the low core embedded stuff. They're usually not competitive in the desktop space, but they make all kinds of stuff. Looks like they're still making like component level stuff for motherboards and things like that. So they're making sub processors, and looks like maybe sound cards and stuff like that. So VIA USB PHY on a Rosewell branded. Oh, so they're okay. Yeah, they're supplying like glue logic and UARTs and shit like that to. Okay.
They're also helping out with the Microsoft's AI system.
Neat. Yeah. So yeah, they're still around. But they ended up with, if I remember correctly, they were the ones who bought out Cyrix and got all the intellectual property. I don't think they kept any of the engineers. I think they bought them out for the property rights and just, you know, closed the factory. But I think it's interesting that Google is just killing hyper-threading on Chromebooks. Because you kind of wonder, did they look at it and say, well, it's a Chromebook, it's really just running a browser. Is that someplace they thought that they could get away with killing hyper-threading without anybody really noticing? I mean, yeah, if you've installed a bunch of Linux apps or Android apps, you might notice it. But I'm thinking a lot of Chromebooks are running those lower-end mobile chips. They probably didn't have hyper-threading anyways. I don't remember, because I know Intel started taking hyper-threading out of a lot of their chips, especially on the lower end. And with the newer core lines, they were taking it out to make more SKUs of the chip. because there was no real reason to buy an i9 when they first came out because it wasn't really that different from an i7. And now they're making versions where, like, you know, unless you buy the certain versions of the chips, hyper-threading's turned off.
And in some of their pre-builts, whenever they run out of the low-end chip, they just tell the high-end chip to act stupid and stick it in there.
Well, I'm also waiting.
Still flash some of that shit.
I'm wondering if you're going to start seeing a few years from now all these guides of make your Chromebook twice as fast, and they talk about turning hyper-threading and all this shit back on, right? So, I don't know. Would suck to be running a major data center right now, though, because... Yeah, this is a massive performance hit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, especially if you're not planning an upgrade for another couple of years. I don't know. How often do you think with these centers do they need to expand?
I know from talking to some of the Google reps two years ago, they were constantly expanding. They were just... You know, they had the way they were doing it, though, is because they were doing a lot of custom hardware. They would build up a rack of machines, go plug it in, and when a machine died in that rack, they'd just turn it off. They wouldn't even bother sending somebody out to fix the rack because they were putting new ones in so often. Eventually, enough machines in that rack would be dead, they'd pull it out and go send it off for servicing, and somebody would pull all the dead bits out of it and rebuild it. But mostly, they were just constantly adding new ones. So they're already doing that kind of stuff. I know Azure was doing something similar where they were constantly expanding. Amazon makes it a big secret where their data centers are and how confident they're expanding. And it's talking to some of the guys who've looked at Microsoft's cloud stuff, apparently most of their stuff is already in shipping containers. They just build out these custom containers that have racks in them. And they just drop them, run power and whatever kind of lines to it.
So just look for a pod yard somewhere, and you have found a data center.
Potentially, actually, yeah. Power, data, and some of them are using water for cooling. They're not cooling the individual systems. It's like it's an AC unit or something like that. So, you know, you hook your three lines up to it, and then you just let it run. And then as machines in them die... they just turn them off in the rack until enough of them are dead that it's worth, you know, taking the thing out of service and dropping a new one in. But apparently they're constantly putting new ones in.
Bruce is wondering if they're constantly putting one in, then this might not be as big a pain in the ass as you'd think. I mean, don't get me wrong, it'll still suck because you are losing some performance. But depending on how fast you're expanding, you can just build that into the expansion.
Well, but I mean, now they have to expand faster to cover it. Because with cloud services, especially if you're building out, you know, modern applications where everything, you know, all your infrastructure's code and all that shit anyways, like, you know, the proper way you're supposed to be doing cloud infrastructure through containerization and shit like that, if it's not running very well on Amazon, fine, fuck them, I'll go over to Azure. Oh, it's not running there, fine, fuck them, I'll go over to Google. Because it's just retargeting your scripts, and usually, if you've written to the cloud-specific features, it's a major pain in the ass to switch. But if you're just running containers and you're running all your own code and you've, you know, completely isolated things, a lot of times it's not that hard to switch where it's running. It just depends on what you've done. That's one of the reasons you see Amazon pumping out new features in their AWS platform all the time. Those features are platform-specific. It's very hard to migrate those somewhere else once they're established. Sorry, are you? I didn't mean to step on you.
No, it's all right. I was just saying, if you're modern computing, man, you're always chasing your tail. It's just the beast.
That's why you all know what I'm going to say next. My favorite computer is...
the Commodore 64.
Damn right. Those things are predictable.
Orps' bank password is...
a dark chuckle and throwing bourbon at the teller.
There you go.
Speaking of throwing things at people, let's move on. We've been talking about processors for half an hour. I'm amazed we talked about it that long, actually. You all kept me going. Kept asking me shit. I'll go all night on that if you let me. Anyways, this one's from Vice and is just amazing. Adobe is telling users they can get sued for using old versions of Photoshop. You are no longer licensed to use the software, Adobe told them. Adobe is warning some owners of its Creative Cloud software applications that they are no longer allowed to use old versions of the software. It's yet another example of how in the modern era you increasingly don't own the things you've spent your hard-earned money on. Adobe this week began sending some of its users to its Lightroom Classic, or began sending some users of its Lightroom Classic, Photoshop, Premiere, Animate, and Media Director programs a letter warning them that they were no longer legally authorized to use the software they may have thought they owned. We recently discontinued certain older versions of Creative Cloud applications, and as a result, under the terms of our agreement, you are no longer licensed to use them, Adobe said in an email. Please be aware that should you continue to use the discontinued versions, you may be at risk of potential claims of infringement by third parties. The company did not inform users why they needed to discontinue the use of the software, but the company's Twitter account indicated the issue stems from ongoing litigation. Apple Insider, which first reported the notices, pointed to a copyright lawsuit filed last year by Dolby Labs. In a controversial move, Adobe pivoted away from the standard software model to the cloud-based subscription model in 2013, resulting in notably higher revenues and higher prices for customers. Dolby's lawsuit accused Adobe of copyright violations related to how the licensing costs Adobe paid to Dolby would be calculated under the new model. In a statement to Motherboard, Adobe confirmed the letter's authenticity, but wouldn't provide any details beyond what was included in the notices. It's yet another example of how the products we buy in modern era can lose functionality or stop working entirely on a lark, be it a game console that loses its features with a firmware update, like they did when they killed Linux on the PlayStations, or entertainment products that just suddenly disappear. That would be things getting yanked out of your Amazon account. It's a problem that is increasingly popping up in the always-online era. Let's see, blah, 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 blah. Dylan Gilbert, a copyright expert with Consumer, said this instance users aren't likely to have much in the way of legal recourse to the sudden shift. Unless Adobe has violated the terms of its licensing agreement by this sudden discontinuance of support for an earlier version of software, which is unlikely, these impacted users just have to grin and bear it, Gilbert said. Yeah, you know Adobe wrote their EULAs ironclad on this shit. Gilbert noted consumers now live in a world where consumers almost never actually own anything that contains software. This new reality, end users are forced to agree to take it or leave it, end user license agreements, in which the licensor can change the terms of service without notice. Even if Adobe is fully in the right here with regard to the Dolby dispute, it has the power to force its customers to upgrade to newer, more expensive versions at a whim, which illustrates the undue power and influence of EULAs over the lives of customers. Gilbert said, we should be able to own the things we buy. Activist, author, and copyright expert Cory Doctorow agreed, telling Motherboard in an email that this kind of thinking has increasingly permeated countless sectors, including DRM-based media, software as a service, and even client-server games. Blah, 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 blah. Your tools are designed to treat you as a mere tenant rather than as owner. You're subject to the whims, machinations, and unforeseeable rights of the landlord from whom you rent, Doctorow noted, and your legal rights are likely defined by a contract that you clicked through a million years ago, which says that you agree you don't have any legal rights. So, yeah. I thought I remembered reading an article a while back about the version of Adobe CS2 that accidentally got released for free with the codes that don't do any verification because they took those servers down. That the wine guys on Linux were really trying to make sure that version worked well. So,
dude, whenever I think Adobe, I think getting screwed in the ass.
I mean, yeah. Really?
I always have. It's their prices, man. Their price point has never set well with me. And the yearly licensing fee? Nah.
Well, you know, it's Suave turned me onto the Affinity software, so that's been a pretty good replacement for some of the software. And, you know, of course, there's a lot of the open source stuff. Oh, I'm sorry, BSV, were you trying to...
Yeah, well, I was just saying, not just Adobe, any high-end software, especially if it's sold to businesses, it's ridiculously high license costs that...
Oh, no shit. Have you tried to get a CAD license lately?
Oh.
Oh, my God.
Man. Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like, shit, no wonder everybody flocks to Fusion 360. It's one of the few that's decent that's free. I mean, there's a handful of others, but it's not really free. That's
by the month now.
Say what?
I think CAD charges licensing by the month.
Some of them do, yeah, because I was trying to see what else was out there besides Fusion for 3D printing. So...
It's ridiculous, but...
I want to see this go to court. I don't know if they would win. You don't always own your shit. I want to see that tested.
That depends on the license agreement.
Well, there's a amount of fraud, though, right? If you say, no, my understanding, because this is a common agreement, that I paid for the software and I have the right to run it in perpetuity because it's I paid for it, whether or not I upgrade to the latest versions or not is irrelevant. And Adobe's coming back saying, no, actually, you purchased a license and we're revoking that license. You know, I don't care what the terms says. Those things are so covered in legalese and so clicked through and nobody reads them. You could make a plausible fraud argument in court. I really think you could.
I don't think a EULA's ever really been challenged, has it?
No.
That's normally why one side or the other caves.
Well, or they go to arbitration, which is why I think you could actually make a pretty good fraud argument with it, because you could say, no, you've represented this on your website at the time as purchasing the software when it's really a limited license that you can revoke on a whim. If I had known you could revoke it on a whim, I wouldn't have purchased it. I would have went with somebody else. The fact that somebody else may or may not exist doesn't really matter. You can make that argument and say it's and basically take them to court for fraud.
Yeah, on all of them, someone else exists. I could have paid someone to build custom software.
Sure.
And also, how many EULAs are not presented till after you purchase?
Well, that's another major thing. Actually, yeah. You know... That you got me thinking about something. I purchased a electric grill a couple of months ago. You know, where I live, the rules got changed. Can't have a real grill, which really sucks because, you know, a good proper charcoal grill is how you want to cook things. So I purchased an electric one so I could, you know, kind of try and be sad about not being, you know, not cooking things properly. And when I opened the box, one of the first things that fell out of it was this thing by saying, using this product, you agree to arbitration that you won't sort, that you won't sue the product. And you flip the thing around, and in very small print on the very bottom of the box, it says includes binding arbitration agreement. I never saw this in the store. I didn't know this existed. It's a fucking EULA on an actual physical product.
And even the statement includes binding arbitration agreement. Without being able to read the terms, you don't know whether or not you'd agree to it until you open it. So I'm thinking that notice isn't a notice.
It's not, because it's hidden in the very bottom of the box, a very small print. And also, I would disregard it. If the thing burned the house down, you know, for whatever reason, I'm still going to sue their asses for a faulty product, right? So I don't care that, you know, they say, oh, we included binding arbitration agreement. I never agreed to a binding arbitration. Well, you purchased the product. Doesn't matter. you don't get to take somebody's legal rights away because they bought something. So I'd need a lawyer willing to actually go to bat on that. So that could be an interesting problem. But, yeah.
I don't know. I think there's a few out there that would do it.
For a contract to be binding, don't you need up for a week to decide? No, there's no time limit on terms there.
On most contracts, there are exceptions. On mortgages, you do have a right of rescission.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a very specific type of contract where they call that out in law. For this kind of shit, it's already legally shady. Like we were just saying, shrink-wrapped agreements have never actually been enforced in court that anybody's aware of. And, of course, they say in it, if you don't agree to this, you have to return the product to the store, which is kind of bullshit, right? You can't – that's basically sneaking a contract in after the fact. Because again, I would say, I would argue that if you're going to say I have to abide by that, that it's fraud because you're misrepresenting what the product is. And by including this shit in there after the fact, you're making it difficult to opt out of the contract. You're unduly difficult because, you know, you have to return the product to the store and you can't, you know, it's a, you know, that's a major pain in the ass.
Because, and then you're also up to the store's return policy.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because they may say return it to the store, but unless they're running the store, they don't get to pick what the store takes back.
Right. So, which is why I kind of laughed when I saw that thing fall out of the box, because it's like, well, this is bullshit. It's unenforceable. It's like, well, by using our product, you agree to binding arbitration. No, I didn't. I bought it secondhand at a garage sale. I never saw a binding arbitration agreement. You know, there's no signature on it. They're just kind of saying, if you use our product, you agree to our terms and services, which works. I mean, it's kind of bullshit in software, too, right? It was originally put in there for, you know, if our software fucks up, you can't sue us for it. But, you know, now it's the fact that they'll be saying, oh, no, you can't use old versions. It's just bullshit. So I do hope this ends up in court and somebody gets these shrink wrap agreements severely weakened, because I don't think they're enforceable at all. Not a lawyer, although I may have considered trying to, you know.
I've mugged one in a parking lot once. Maybe.
Don't think you should admit to that.
Especially uncredited.
I actually have thought about, you know, it's like, what, can I do online law school? I mean, it'd be kind of fun to get into at times, but then it's like, man, that's a lot of work. And money. So.
Oh, depending on where you are. I haven't checked out the rules for your state, but some states just require you pass the bar. You don't actually have to go to law school.
Well, I mean, that would be something to do, wouldn't it? Just go pass the bar exam because you can. It's like, what school did you go to? The internet.
Lincoln did it.
Yeah, I guess that's true. So.
Most of the seminal cases argued before the Supreme Court have been argued by people that do not have law degrees.
I'm just thinking it would be fun to you know, be able to get some good understanding of law, even if it's not perfect. And, you know, yeah, if you could pass the bar, get accredited as a lawyer, as somebody who actually understands how this shit works, you could probably make some pretty good money. Being a lawyer that understands computers, like really understands them.
There's a couple out there. There's a couple that do podcasts too.
Yeah, that's true. So,
because when it comes to lawyers, you have a degree in something before you go to law school. That degree in something doesn't necessarily have anything to do with law. I know people that have a bachelor's in history. Then they went to law school, or political science, and then they went to law school. You just have to get a bachelor's in something before you can get accepted to law school.
Would be kind of fun. Be expensive as hell on the time sink, though.
Yeah. You can do it the Saul route, community college. Any of them offer law degrees?
Yeah.
Better call Saul.
Yeah, but then you'd know exactly what's wrong with doing this show and all the shit we're saying. It's like, yep, I found out it's actually illegal 6 ways to Sunday, so...
I don't care.
Moving on, this one's from NPR. FCC wants phone companies to start blocking robocalls by default. If the government's new plan works, the number of robocalls you'd receive may go down in the near future. The Federal Communications Commission is proposing to push phone companies to block unwanted calls to their customers by default.
How do they define unwanted?
That's a broad statement, man. If enacted, yeah. The proposal would not compel phone companies to impose default call blocks. But it would shield telecom providers from legal liability for blocking certain calls. The American people are fed up with illegal robocalls, and it's the top complaint received from consumers each and every year, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai told reporters. And we believe we need to make it easier for phone companies to block these robocalls. This would be a minor change from now, when customers typically need to opt in to unwanted call blocking. And the proposal, carriers should simply have to allow consumers who do not want that kind of service to opt out, Pai said. He said it would be comparable to the way email providers filter messages into spam folders. Oh, I don't know about that. The FCC is pushing for phone companies to use an authentication framework for blocking unwanted calls that is dubbed Shaken/Stir. It's a way for phone companies to verify that a call is actually coming from where the caller ID says it is. The call blocking company Umail issues estimates of nationwide robocalls each month. It estimates there were 4.9 billion calls placed in April 2019, a rate of 14.99 calls per person. Our belief now is that over half of the robocalls out there are scams, Alex Quisilli, a robocall expert in the CEO of Umail, told NPR. The rising problem is calls that are spoofed, meaning they disguise their identity on caller ID. U.S. Telecom, a trade group that represents telecommunications providers, applauded the FCC's proposal. The criminals that are scamming consumers with this flood of illegal robocalls must be confronted by industry and government head-on, the group's president and CEO, Jonathan Spalter, said in a statement. This is a big and bold proposal by the FCC that can bolster our industry's cutting-edge call blocking and authentication efforts and do something important, stop unwanted calls from reaching consumers in the first place. The FCC has previously encouraged companies to take firmer action against scam robocalls, but it may be a challenge for companies to figure out which robocalls are truly scams and which contain information that a consumer would want to get, like automatic calls about school closings. And according to Quisilli, one of the challenges to stemming relentless robocalls is that companies have been reluctant to assume legal liability for blocking calls that customers wanted. What we find is there's a range of these things that people aren't comfortable with having blocked, he told NPR. Quisilli said it's safe to assume everyone would want to block scam calls, but other types are less clear. For example, some people want to receive automated payment reminders from credit card companies, where others might prefer to block such calls. And then there are extreme examples, he added, that might have made providers reluctant to embrace sweeping action in the past that could expose them to legal liability. It's the fear that you block a number and it's grandma calling and she's having a heart attack. I love that that's the example they go to.
Well, it's an extreme example, but yeah, you know, the falling pendants and stuff like that, when an elderly person falls, even if they're knocked out, the thing will ring 000 or a couple of 911 or a relative's number.
Yeah. It's very important that the proposal makes it clear that emergency and other vital calls are not blocked, and that these carriers give consumers ample information about these services and methods, Pai told reporters. The FCC has not yet released specific details of its proposal in particular, what kind of guidelines the agency will provide companies for determining whether a call is wanted or unwanted. Will Wilquist, a spokesperson for the FCC, said the call blocking programs would be based on reasonable analytics, like current call blocking apps. He said the analytics are aimed at stopping scams, look for patterns like floods of calls in the network or numerous short-duration calls. Wilquist added that the proposal would allow for flexibility about what to block or for customers to opt out altogether. The FCC's proposal would also allow providers to offer customers even more aggressive forms of blocking than the default. If past customers could opt into a filter system that would only allow calls through from numbers in their contacts, dubbed a whitelist. The number of robocalls we get is insane. For too long, the FCC has wasted time. Blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, just politicians talking about it there. I don't know. I honestly don't know where I fall on this. I kind of like the idea that the government's saying, hey, we're not going to hold you liable if you're running an automated call blocking thing and it's a little too aggressive. Just because the amount of noise... I get about 3 scam calls a day. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, that's about the same.
So, if those went away, would I be upset? Nope. But I have, in the past, not answered the phone to things that were important because I didn't recognize the number and thought it was a scam call, right?
Oh, yeah. If I don't recognize the number, I don't pick it up, and if you don't leave a message, I might not call you back.
Yeah.
That's pretty much how it is for me.
That's what a lot of people are doing, but you know, then you read the articles. What if you got somebody who's like a doctor or, you know, pager, emergency services, and there were articles about those people not answering the phone because they get so many scam calls, they assumed it was another one. And
oh, it's not just that. Calls coming in, banks generally don't have a person call you. They have a robot call you, and if you pick up, they may connect you to a person.
Yeah.
So my method of sending it to the voicemail, the robot doesn't know that it went to voicemail. It just gets no response and hangs up. Doesn't leave a message necessarily.
That's how the Red Cross works for trying to get donations.
Same thing with a lot of IRS warnings.
Well, I mean, you think about what Suave was talking about earlier before he logged out, where he was saying, well, what if, you know, what if we get the call saying, hey, there's bad weather in your area, or the example in there about schools calling and saying, hey, school's closed.
So,
although the weather alerts are generally not by somebody calling you, but I do know a lot of the schools do.
Yeah.
They do. You can sign up for text alerts on weather.
Yeah. So
schools, they usually just have it announced on radio and television. I don't know of a lot of schools that do calls, or has that changed?
A lot of people I work with, they have kids, and yeah, their schools are calling them or shooting them texts.
I was going to say, nobody really listens to the radio in the morning anymore. Not that I'm aware of, anyway.
I listen to the radio.
At work, when we first blocked all the social media networks, I had several people complain that they needed access to Twitter because their kid's school posts information about what's going on at the school on their Twitter page, and they needed to be able to see that in case an emergency or something happened.
That's what their phone's for.
Well, and that was our argument, was like, well, you know, you can kick your phone off the, you know, use that. But, you know, it's a real question when you start looking at, you know, doing hardcore blocking like this of what if you block something important? See, I've at work, I've been round and round and round about this on email blocking of all things and web page blocking, that there are very real legitimate arguments. Now, occasionally you have that fucktard who says, oh no, my entire team needs to get these emails. These are spam emails. You don't want your team getting these. These are bullshit. No, I think it's important. I think my whole team needs to get these. It's like, oh God, we've got somebody who doesn't understand things in a position of authority. Fuck. You know, and then that's always a fun conversation. It's like, no, these are ads. Well, I think these are important. This is what they're using to determine rates. No, I promise you it's not. But, you know, they don't know that. But they think it's important that their team gets it, and, you know, round and round and round. And it's one of those things where they make so much noise about it, management says, just give them what they want, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's not worth the argument.
Automate your own spam to him.
Yeah, no shit. We did have one guy we did that for. Because nobody on his team wanted the spam. That's why it got blocked in the first place. They asked us to block it. So we unblocked it for him. And I had to write a whole bunch of custom email rules for him because it was silly. But it was better than dealing with people bitching about getting these emails all day long. So, yeah. And, you know, when we were changing email systems, I had to review all the whitelists, and we had one guy who had whitelisted every email that was ever blocked. It's like a whole bunch of obvious scams, fake domains, bullshit. Yeah, whitelisted. Just like, fuck.
But how else will I know whether or not this prince I sent money to will pay me back?
Yeah, there probably, you know, there probably is some Nigerian royalty. We're like, no, guys, really?
No, really. He is my second fucking cousin. We are friends. We grew up together, went to school in the States. I do know a Nigerian prince. We are currently managing his hedge fund. You cannot block his email address. I know it looks like a scam.
Actually, I get the I haven't gotten one in a bit. I used to get the emails all the time of, we noticed you've blocked our email service. Our email service is not spammers. People have signed up and requested these. You look at the email. No, they didn't. But, I mean, yeah, I quit even bothering to check because we were getting so many of them. But, yeah, for a while there, you were getting these all the damn time of, hey, you can't block us. People are asking for these. And you go, look, it's some marketing service. It's bullshit, right? But, yeah, they were actively emailing email. They've been saying, hey, you can't block us. What are you doing? And, you know, you just ignore them and keep blocking them. But, you know.
Respond, my job.
Yep. So, I don't know. I just, on one hand, I could see it being slippery slope, right? Because, okay, well, they can automatically block these kind of calls. Well, you know, you get into the same kind of arguments you get with internet blocking, right? Well, if you can block all the kiddie porn, why can't you block piracy?
Yeah.
You know, if you can block whatever, why can't you block hate speech? And you get into that shit, you know? I mean, it gets bad. So, anyways, let's go on to this article. I think RU actually pointed this one out to me the other day, but it may not be the same link. This is from metro.co.uk. A man was fined £90 for refusing to show his face to police trialing new facial recognition software. He covered his face.
A license for that face, mate.
Do you have a license for that face? That's when you pull out the fake fit, you know, the leather face and say, nope.
We were speaking about Euler's before, like they're trialing this. Hey, they didn't ask this guy if he'd like to be involved in the trial. There's when you're going to be involved in it, and here's a penalty for trying to get around it. Like, that's just bullshit, man.
So the guy was just on the street, and they...
Yep.
Yeah.
The man pulled his jumper up above his chin as he walked past Met police officers trialing live facial recognition software in East London. BBC cameras filmed as officers swooped on the man, told him to wind his neck, and then handed him the hefty penalty charge. A campaigner from Big Brother Watch, who were protesting the use of cameras on the day, was also filmed telling the officer, "I would have done the same." The police said they made 3 arrests thanks to the cameras on the day in question, and a total of 8 people, including 2 14-year-old boys, were arrested during the course of the trial. Those against the move urged the cameras argued the cameras are a breach of privacy. In the video, the man, who has not been named, explains how he was pulled over by an officer who got his back up. He told the BBC, "I spoke to the man who said there's facial recognition down there, so it's a cold day. I pulled my jumper up over my mouth and gone. Police officers asked me to come over, so I've got my back up." I basically told him to fuck off. I said I don't want my face shown on anything. If I want to cover my face, I'll cover my face. It's not for them to tell me not to cover my face. So now I've got a £90 fine. Well done. The Home Office has previously said facial recognition can be an invaluable tool in fighting crime. But campaigners say that as there is no legislation for it in the UK, it is being used without regulation. In the footage, the man is seen being cornered by a group of officers, telling them, "If I want to cover my face, I will. Don't push me over when I'm walking down the street. How would you like it if you walked down the street and somebody grabbed you?" He is told by an officer, "Wind your neck in." A concerned witness asked another officer, "What's your suspicion?" He tells her that the fact that he walked past clearly marked signs for facial recognition and he has covered his face. She responds, I would do the same. When he tells her it gives the police just grounds to stop him, she says in shock, "No, it doesn't." The incident occurred during a trial in February, and Met says the public will be well informed before trials due to take place. So if you're walking by, they're going to start stationing people by the signs. If you see a sign that says facial recognition technology, it's like, yeah, why don't we go down the other street? I don't feel like getting irradiated today. Yeah, they're going to arrest you on the spot. It's nope. Like you were avoiding the facial recognition.
State.
So we absolute now state of have checkpoints, essentially, you're saying.
Sounds like it.
In the UK, yeah.
Lovely. Oh,
it'll be coming to you too. Like they trialed it here for the Olympics or Commonwealth Games, I think it was. And the police flat out just started using it to target other people for non-crimes. It was ridiculous. They completely abused and abused it.
So
for non-crimes, what do you mean?
Like dude drops a cigarette butt. You know, they review the tape, and then quick, where is he? And they'll find him in the crowd using the facial recognition software. Where other times they just walk through. You know what I mean?
So they're getting him for littering rather than him for littering.
The trial was meant to be used for dangerous criminals getting in, i.e. terrorists, murderers, shit like that. People are looking for on the wanted list. They just started using it for slight infraction penalties and stuff like that.
So this is where it's going to be worth it to go on, what's the website, Hyperflesh, that has those very, very realistic rubber masks. Like the giant babies and shit like that? Yeah, that's it.
I watched them pass a law about evading facial recognition software and having an instant jail time for it as a deterrent.
San Francisco, they just passed a law forbidding police from using facial recognition.
I'm just thinking, you know, get a bunch of these hyper-realistic masks and walk by them and just let them run the facial scan on that. Of course, it's obviously a mask, although the Heisenberg mask isn't bad.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think they'll start prosecuting you for doing that.
For wearing a mask,
doing it, yeah.
It's like, why are you wearing that mask? Because I do spray painting.
Your best bet for this is to buy a full body burqa. And you're good.
Claim to be an Islamic woman. Got it.
Yeah. Why not, dude? If you can claim you're something to these days and people have to accept it, then, yeah, call me an Islamic woman.
Of course, you want to do it right. Let me click this on.
I'm an Islamic woman.
It's ma'am.
It right button.
It's ma'am.
That's what you got to do, right? Oh, fuck. What was the... We had the audio for IHN a few years ago where it was the guy doing the radio show in drag. And in the middle of it, the producer's like, dude, they're gonna start trying to kill you. You might want to defend yourself. And he just turns her.
I'm not sure I have a problem with it. It's already legal to film you in public. You're still in public. You're still being filmed. It's just instead of waiting days to track you down, they're trying to do it in real time.
Well, it's the whole thing of forcing you to show your face. Around here, it gets really cold during winter.
See, that's my that's what I'm thinking. Is if you're just legitimately wearing a balaclava because it's cold?
Yeah. I think the cops there were overstepping it, but I don't see a problem with using facial recognition.
Why can't I just carry ID?
I mean, what if you're wearing? What if you have a cold and you're going around wearing a SARS mask? Are you going to get fined for that?
What if you're
fine with people wearing masks? I'm just not seeing the problem with the actual use of the software itself. I think the cops overdid it when they stopped the guy because his face was covered. If it looked like he covered his face for a legitimate reason.
I mean, how many people have buried their, you know, have buried their nose and down in a jacket, you know, because it's fucking cold?
If it's cold, do it. But I can also see that being suspicious depending on the circumstance. I don't cover my face when walking into a bank because that can get you locked in a panic room.
Have you seen the GIF of the guy going up to the police officer asking where the nearest bank is? And when he says, oh, it's around the corner, he grabs the it looks like he's just wearing I guess the word would be a toque, you know, just that kind of hat. And he pulls it down, it's a balaclava, and he just starts going, and the cop goes, hey!
Yeah, it's a good one.
Actually, it'd be worth learning how to do silicone prosthetics, if facial recognition is going to be that common of a thing. Just learn to make fake noses, right?
There you go.
Oh, when it gets that common, they're probably going to be doing the infrared scans rather than face. They're a bit more accurate and require more than makeup to fake.
But still, can you imagine the number, you know, just wearing a different false nose every day and then one day just going, you know, just like, oh, fuck it, and wearing the clown nose?
Yeah. That's one reason I'm thinking the infrared scans. That and that can tell twins apart.
Damn. All right, let's move on to this next one. Because I think we all agree that the cops are overreacting to the dude just keeping it, you know, zipping the collar up over the face.
It wasn't worth a 90-pound fine. Like, that's a lot of money.
It wasn't worth a 90-pound fine. It wasn't worth stopping him.
Yeah. Also, they're doing a trial. He's just giving them a different data set.
There you go, BSV.
I like what Rats is saying in the chat room. Surgical mask lined with a Reynolds wrap. No, I have a cold, officer. Well, I mean, I guess what bothers me is they were making the argument that, oh, you're trying to evade the facial recognition technology. That's probable cause.
Dude, you're like, fucking reaching on that one.
Yeah, I'm really reaching on that one.
Boyle would block infrared ratings.
The good stuff would. Like, you know, the high-end Reynolds wrap? Yeah, I'll bet that'd do it.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got your dollar store tinfoil, you probably need a couple of layers.
Line all your clothes with thermo blankets.
You're going to sweat like a bitch.
Great weight loss fucking idea, though.
There used to be a company that made that copper weave that was supposed to be a Faraday cage. You imagine a jacket and a hat and all that shit made out of that stuff? I don't know if they're still around. I don't remember what they were called well enough to Google it either. But at this point, I don't care. I think it's time to move on.
I don't know. If you're going to work that way around, I just do the ball cap with a couple of infrared LEDs. Flash the camera out. Humans aren't going to see it. The camera's going to be blind. Somebody actually watching the cameras are going to coordinate and find out which individual's wearing that hat, and I'm going to go to jail. But until that happens...
No, somebody's going to run over, grab your hat, and start stomping on it. And you're like, what the fuck? It's not even my MAGA hat. I don't understand.
Oh, no, dude. It's going to be my MAGA hat. That, and I'm going to also have one of the little Jew hats. So when they do it, I can call him an anti-Semitic bastard, you Nazi faggot. And sue them for, discrimination, for religious discrimination.
It's a yarmulke, madman, not a little Jewish hat.
I like what Rats is saying in the chat room. Get one of those Mylar blankets and then start, cut chunks out of it. And he would say, yeah, you're right, that would work. But here's where you have fun with it. You get the Mylar blanket, you line your coat with it, or, you know, your hat or your SARS mask or whatever. But when you cut chunks out of it, like, make it in the shape of something. Like, make it say, fuck you, cops, or something like that. So the guy sees it when they're running the scan. Or, you know, just the middle finger. Whatever.
It works.
Yeah. Next article is from CNBC.com. And I believe you sent me this one. This is from Paris. The leaders of New Zealand and France on Wednesday urged technology giants to clean their platforms of extremist content at a meeting of world leaders and tech executives. The United States was nowhere to be found. French President Emmanuel Macron and New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. Ardern, thank you. Unveiled plans. I'm not actually trying to insult the woman. I'm sure she deserves it. I'm American.
She's a horse-faced cunt.
There you go. See, that's an actual insult versus me just mispronouncing her name because I'm American and don't know better. Unveiled plans to rein in tech companies over the unfettered sharing of toxic content like hate speech and terrorist material online. Measures announced Wednesday included the development of tools to block people from downloading violent content, including transparency around how tech platforms find and remove content, and the requirement that tech companies' algorithms do not direct users to violent content. The so-called Christchurch call and a summit aimed at signing countries and companies up to a pledge to clamp down on hateful content comes after shootings at two mosques in New Zealand, city of Christchurch, in which a gunman broadcast the attack live on Facebook. Facebook said the video was viewed 4,000 times before it was taken down, but that didn't stop the clip from being spread on the social network and other platforms, including YouTube and Twitter. Facebook and New Zealand's leaders, or I'm sorry, I read that wrong, France's and New Zealand's leaders said the governments alone could not tackle the problem of online extremism and that tech companies must also play a role. Yeah, because nobody has a clue of how to do this shit.
Sorry. They talk about extremist content. Is this an extremist climate change content they're going to pull down? Because that shit gives me the fear.
Well, I mean, they're not just defining what extremist content is. Sure, it's easy to point at the Christchurch shooting video and say, yeah, that's extremist content. Because if anybody's watched it, it's pretty rough. But, you know, what if you've just got somebody sitting there saying ideas they don't agree with?
Dude, if you think the Christchurch shooting video is a rough video, you haven't watched many videos, man. Like, it's pretty fucking lame. It's pretty tame. Compared to, say, some ISIS content that's regularly available on YouTube.
Okay, a lot of things are tame when you're comparing it to dropping people alive in a deep fryer.
That's what I'm saying, man. Like, it's... You can't... I don't find that hard to watch.
Okay, I have not watched the dropping people in a deep fryer video, although I think they did that in an anime.
You don't want to watch it.
You don't want to watch it, man. It's fucking rough. And drowning people in cages and shit. But I don't want it to go away because it's there, it exists, it happened. I want to bear witness to history. Well, like,
it's a Streisand effect. What's the easiest way to get a whole bunch of interest in some content online? Censor it.
Yeah, but it's not. I'm not interested in it because they're censoring it. I've been watching this shit for the last 10 years because it's history. Like, if we had cameras back in the Battle of Waterloo, would you want that censored? Even though there are men losing legs and arms and eyes and heads and stuff like that. No, you'd want to see it. Because it's historical content.
Let me clarify. I would want the option of seeing it.
That's what I'm saying. I want the option. I don't want it to go away. I'd like it just to be, let's just have, are you 18? Yes or no? Click.
Well, because
that'll keep the kids out.
Yeah, sure.
Because they'll go, oh, shit, I'm not 18. I can't watch that. Oh, no. And they'll go away. Because that's how that works.
But Rats is talking about something called a debt cord noose. And it's like, I know what debt cord is, and I know what a noose is.
I've seen that video.
I don't
want to
see
that.
I don't want to see that.
I've seen it, but they were coming up with some really creative ways of executing people. I don't want to say murder because it was a war zone at the time. Those videos are out there, and they're still accessible. I don't want them taken down because I want to... Because if you go telling the average normie, hey, you know they use debt cord to murder 10 soldiers, they'll go bullshit. And then you go, no, not true. And then they'll go bullshit. And then you go, no, check the video out. And they'll never want to know about anything ever again.
As a sad, or that'll say, man, look at that After Effects work.
But, well, that too. This is how the Vietnam War got stopped. Because they showed the graphic fucking content of real life. You can't just deny real life because it upsets you. And that's what these people seem to be doing.
The Vietnam War got stopped because enough people with microphones said we were losing when we were not.
But it was the footage as well being shown every night. It turned a lot of people around. It's not the exact thing that stopped Vietnam. I know. God damn, I hate this show sometimes because you have to be so fucking correct. you can't just throw it out there and expect no one to fucking check it. You know what I mean? It was the graphic content. It was a lot of things, but it was the shit being shown on the nightly news that made people go, holy fuck, look what we're doing.
Well, that's the legend, right? Is that once Walter Cronkite said it was over, Nixon was like, well, fuck.
Yeah, it images can change people's minds, especially when, I think if people saw, if they were broadcasting on the nightly news, Gabe's being thrown off rooftops, the debt cord one, the burning in the cages,
lining up 200 Christians on the Mediterranean shore, cutting their heads off and sending the blood to Italy for the Pope. Yeah, that would change people's minds.
You would have a lot of people saying, Mr. President, Mr. Trump, would you get the Marines over there to solve that problem?
Exactly, man. The execution of the Tigris in 2010, holy fuck, that was bad. But yeah, if we were actually showing this footage, this kumbaya with the LGBT and the fucking Muslims would cease instantly. It's because we're not shown reality anymore. We don't believe it. And then when they do see it, we get so upset about it, we freak out, faint onto a couch and scream something about the children. And then you get these two idiots. And one thing before I finish is just ask yourself, what do France and New Zealand historically have in common when it comes to world events? Just Google it yourself, kids. There's no grand conspiracy, by the way. And if you find anything, let me know. I want to know. That's all I have to say on that. And we've been going for an hour and a half. Heads up.
I'm ready to move on. BSV, Madman, you have anything else on that?
I'm good.
All right.
Yeah, I'm good.
Last news article for the night. This is from PC Mag. Won't take us that long, I promise. Internet meme pioneer, YTMND, shuts down. You're the man now, dog. Pioneer in internet meme space has shut down. The online community at ytmnd.com allows users to upload an image or a GIF and pair it with audio for hilarious results. Traffic to the website, however, dried up years ago with the rise of Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. In 2016, the site creator Max Goldberg said YTMND would likely shut down soon due to declining ad revenue and his ill health. Speaking of, it seemed like the internet had moved on, Goldberg told Gizmodo at the time. The site dates back to 2001, when Goldberg paired a looping audio clip of Sean Connery uttering the line, "You're the man now, dog," with some text and placed it all on a webpage, youarethemannowdog.com. In 2004, Goldberg expanded on that with a site that let users pair images and audio so they could create clips and post them online. The end result was YTMND, which by 2006 was reportedly amassing 4 million visitors a month and 120,000 contributions. By 2012, it had almost a million pages devoted to user-created memes, but it couldn't compete with the rise of social media and the smartphone. What prompted Goldberg to finally pull the plug on the site in recent days isn't clear. He and the site didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. However, all pages have been saved on the Internet Archive and the Wayback Machine. So you'll still be able to enjoy the site's content for nostalgia's sake. Anybody else remember that site? There was some interesting shit on there. There's a lot of bullshit, but there was some interesting shit on there.
I can't say I ever heard of it until today.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not a big meme sort of dude.
Well, okay, to be fair, this was, you know, the MySpace, you know, LiveJournal era of shit. So
yeah, I was around during MySpace, man, and yeah, still.
Yeah, okay. Well, a lot of people would link to it off
with
off
hanging
post.
Out with people.
Yeah. A lot of people would link to the page on this where you'd have whatever GIF playing and the audio going in the background, but half the time you'd have to click play on the audio based on what browser you're using, and it got weird. But it was kind of between that and GeoCities, that's what people were doing before Tumblr.
Yeah. Yep. A bit like Newgrounds.
Yeah. Although Newgrounds is starting to see a resurgence, apparently, with YouTube getting more crazy and other sites getting more crazy. So. All right. Well, I said it wouldn't take long. Let's do this. And I'm going to point out, we only are going an hour and a half because you fuckers got me talking about, you know, freaking processor shit.
Yeah, it's our fault. It's our fault you're hooked on heroin.
Yeah, just point and shout nerd while you're at it, right? Anyways. Two things for you tonight in Dojo. The first is a really fun write-up on busting some of the myths on Tor from privacytrolls.io. And apparently they're going to do more because they called this part one. But it's an interesting write-up on kind of a high-level overview of how Tor works, what it's doing. And then they go into a whole bunch of myths and like the backdoors or like the idea that there are government backdoors into Tor because they helped fund it. And they're like, no, it was written by this project. But yes, the Navy did, in fact, help fund it. But their reasoning was whatever. And, you know, they've got a whole bunch of myth busting. It's not a long read. It's really not. It doesn't go into too many technical details of Tor. But if you're wanting to explain it to somebody, it's a good read. If you've never messed with it or you're just kind of curious, it's a nice, you'd call it, say, the 5,000-foot overview. Because it's not getting down into the nitty-gritty of how it works, but it's, you know, a rough idea of how it works. So, I thought it was a nice write-up. It's an easy one to pass off, and you don't actually have to understand, you know, encryption and routing to understand the write-up.
Well, sounds good. I'll take a look.
And the last thing I have for you tonight in Digital Dojo is a command line tool called Mole. This is a tool for setting up SSH tunnels between, you know, an SSH server and, say, servers behind a firewall that the SSH server can talk to, or maybe you're behind some kind of a filter and you want a way to get out of that. You know, it's a way of getting that if you can get to your SSH server. There is nothing this tool does that you couldn't actually do with the regular SSH command line tools or PuTTY on a Windows box, but it simplifies it. It's a dedicated tool for the task. It's fairly simple to set up. And he's got a pretty good write-up on how to use it, and it's a little cleaner as far as doing dedicated tunnels versus where when you do it with PuTTY or the regular SSH tools, you end up with, you know, open connections, you end up with various terminals open. It can get a little confusing as to what you're doing. This is a nice service. So, like, if you're automating connections in the background, like, you're going to have scripts on your box that constantly keep certain connections up, this would be a good tool for doing that kind of thing. So it's a nice little tool. It's not, you know, if you're not up on SSH tunneling, SSH is a remote communications protocol primarily used on, Linux machines this day and age. But it encapsulates file transfer, console, and you can tunnel traffic over it. So one of the old school tricks we used to use back when I was going to school to get around the web proxy, because the web proxy sucked. It wasn't even what they were filtering. It was the fact that the thing was just slow as Christmas. Like, it wasn't a connection problem. It was just their proxy was badly configured and running on old hardware. So, like, yeah. Their internet connection was fine, but their proxy sucked. So you'd use an SSH tunnel and browse through that, and your web browsing was better. Half the shit you were going to wasn't even blocked. You were just doing it for speed. You know? Although, yeah, it would get you around web blocks and shit like that, too. So another good use of this is if you've set up, say, a lab at home, you can have one single SSH server that you've exposed to the internet, maybe on an odd port, you know, using certificate authentication. Maybe you're getting really fancy and doing things like where you're doing SSH keys based off hardware tokens, because you can do that with, like, YubiKeys, the modern builds of YubiKeys. You can put the GPG keys on the YubiKey. So you can do that for authentication. So you've got an actual hardware token to get into it. And then you could do tunneling back into your network through that SSH server, so you don't need to do an actual VPN. I in fact, a lot of guys, you'll see people talking about doing SSH tunneling as the poor man's VPN. So the other nice thing about doing an SSH tunnel is, let's say you don't want to do a full VPN. Maybe you're in a network where you need to connect to internal resources. You need to run things that are on the other network, and a full VPN would, take over your network, and now you wouldn't be able to connect to internal resources because everything would be going through the VPN. So an SSH tunnel is kind of a way around that, where you can bounce through the SSH server, but only on certain ports. So you can tell some programs to use the tunnel and other programs not to.
Neat.
So. Yeah, there's a lot you can do with this if you take the time to really dig into it and come up with some ideas. But that's all.
People in certain countries can start looking at 4chan again.
Yeah, there you go. You just need somebody to ring an SSH server and some reason to explain why you're connected to an SSH server all day rather than browsing the internet. Or you have a script running that's constantly hitting some, I don't know, regular news sources and, you know, approved YouTube channels to make it look like you're a good little citizen where you're actually connecting to the tunnels on the back end so you can go to the real content.
I'll take my day in court.
But
fuck him, man. Fuck him.
That's all I got for tonight. Of course, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Pure Decking every Thursday. IHM, whenever the hell we feel like it. The Galaxy 15 radio site, the subreddit, and the IRC. Tonight in the IRC, apparently I've been kicked out, so zero users. They've been having net splits all night. So.
Okay.
Yeah. Before, we had Iron Angel, Her Rats, Sardonyx, myself, Madman, but yeah, Freenode's having problems tonight, so it's kind of hard to say who's currently in there at the moment. Cykros may or may not have been in there. He's been quiet. And yeah, that's all I've got. BSV, closing thoughts.
I can't call it
future news because both Madman and RU are here, and you know, I'll get jumped.
I have no thoughts at the moment. I'll get back to you.
Possibly in the future?
Better than getting back to you in the past. Maybe a bit more complicated.
No, I would be impressed if you got back to me in the past. It's like, oh, there's BSV and his DeLorean. And my hand's fading away. What the fuck did he do?
Mr. Stark.
I don't feel so good. I don't want to go.
That's nice, but I have these numbers. I must go to a gas station quickly.
Now, there's an interesting thought. What if the lottery is actually just a trap for time travelers?
I think there's a movie in that.
I think there's a series of books in that. Madman, closing thoughts.
I see in the future it's going to be illegal to wear any type of face coverings in Britain unless you're a Muslim. And then there's going to be a large convergence, at least if you're walking down the street, to Islam. Now, when you get to the pub and take off the burqa, you'll be a normal man again.
All right, are you close us out?
The story before we went to air, the F-16 crashing into a warehouse. Yeah, it's true. It's crashed in a warehouse.
Where at?
I want to say Florida, but California. There we go.
Okay, so it was a US F-16.
Yeah. Yeah, pilot survived. Looks like the warehouse is pretty fucked, though.
Yeah, I got hit by an F-16.
Shit happens. Hey, imagine the poor fucker who has to fill out the insurance form. Reason for the incident, pilot error. You're a warehouse.
The military was fucking with me.
No, I'm serious. A jet ran through a fucking warehouse.
Now that's the question. Money. Is the insurance going to pay for it? Is he going to have to sue the military?
He's not going to have to sue the military, but the military will cover it.
Yeah.
All right. I think that's it. I think it's time to start playing our closing sounds.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
Sounds good. Nose down and call it a night.
Shut up, Wesley.